The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. This edition of Time Magazine is dated December 5/December 12, 2022. It is typically bordered in red on the front cover with a narrow white marginal inside border. Time is superimposed in large block lettering in off gray, I guess, upon a brown, gradations of brown background, and features a portrait of Steven Spielberg, peering askance from the camera. Actually, he's wearing trifocals. I just noticed that. He has not long and not short gray hair and gray facial hair. This is a portrait with him leaning his chin upon a hand clasped over another. His right hand is clasped over his left arm, and he appears to be sitting on a wrought iron chair, or at least we see the chair back. Dressed in a dark plaid sports coat, perhaps, or suit coat, it's charcoal gray to brown, I would say, with a woven windowpane plaid in off gray. And I see a blue denim cuff peering out from one of the sleeves. That's it for the cover. And now to the view inbox. And this is the D.C. Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. There's a photo here of a book, and it says, "So Help Me G." I think the rest of it is cut off. I think that it's titled So Help Me God. It's by Mike Pence and features a photo of him front and center sitting on concrete steps is what it looks like. He's dressed in blue, possibly blue denim trousers and a blue maybe corduroy sports jacket and a blue Oxford shirt underneath. He's smiling at the camera. He has short white hair. And this is by Philip Elliott. As Mike Pence's armored SUV arrived at the U.S. Capitol January 6, 2021, the vice president turned to his daughter with a mix of frustration and compassion for the thousands already gathered on the East Front. "God bless those people," he said. "They're going to be so disappointed." Thus begins a harrowing climax to the former vice president's memoirs, released November 15, just hours before former President Donald Trump officially launched a 2024 comeback effort. Pence's book, So Help Me God, chronicles plenty of contradictions in his rise to power. The book is the most credible defense to date of the Trump administration's 4 years in power from one of its senior members. That does not mean it is all positive. For instance, Pence says Trump was wrong to criticize Kassir and Ghazala Khan, two Gold Star parents who were supporters of Hillary Clinton in 2016. Argues Trump erred in picking his then-buddy Jeff Sessions as Attorney General, given Sessions' involvement in a campaign-era meeting with the Russian ambassador and subsequent obfuscation about it, and writes with frustration about how Trump directly contradicted Pence's denial that the decision to fire then-FBI Director James Comey had anything to do with the investigations into Russia. clocking in at more than 500 pages. Pence's missive is as much about what has come before as what may come after. He describes in detail how he chose to sign up with a presidential nominee whose temperament could hardly have been more anathema to his. But it is clear the Indiana Republican had not shelved his ambitions then and seems primed now to launch his own 2024 White House bid, regardless of Trump. With many in the party blaming Trump for a disappointing showing during the November 8 elections, the prospect of Pence as a Trump without baggage option could find receptive ears as long as there is sufficient respect for the father of the movement that rebooted the GOP. After all, everyone knows MAGA leadership is non-transferable. The current Republican Party is highly unlikely to nominate an openly never-Trump candidate for much of anything, which explains why most of Pence's tone is laudatory. But Pence has long maintained friendships throughout the party, from the country club set to the evangelical wing. It certainly helps explain how Trump and his team wound up selecting Pence over options who were more closely aligned with Trump's style of antagonism. Pence's book on its own, Bible verses sprinkled throughout, is unlikely to break the fever of the current Republican Party, but it does have utility in understanding how at least some in the GOP see the path to power in a post-2020 world, one in which election denialism might help a candidate win Trump's endorsement, but not necessarily a seat with any power. Pence is a seasoned Paul, having risen in House leadership before moving into the Indiana governor's mansion, a perch from which his socially conservative policies made him simultaneously a star on the right and a threat on the left. When Trump needed a reliable conservative to prove to the party he was not going to go wobbly, there was no one better than Pence on the audition line. Yet looking at a potential Trump-Joe Biden rematch, there's curiosity about if Trump remains a viable option. After all, Pence may have picked up enough Trumpism after seeing it up close to wield it for his own chase. Essay, You Might Want to Quiet Quit, Housework 2. By Kate Mangino, M-A-N-G-I-N-O, who's the author of Equal Partners, Improving Gender Equality at Home. All of a sudden, everyone seems to know the term quiet quitting. It is alliterative and descriptive, and its deep resonance demonstrates just how fried we all feel. Defined as no longer going above and beyond at work, but simply completing necessary tasks, quiet quitting can feel like the last form of agency for the exhausted and unappreciated workers, burned out from trying to meet employers' unrealistic expectations. As a researcher of gender dynamics and household work, I cannot help but see similarities between our homes and our current workplace conditions. We may like to think we've achieved gender equality at home, but we have not. Research involving household chore journals, where participants log time spent on domestic tasks each day, tells us that in different sex partnerships, where both people work outside the home, two-thirds of housework continues to fall on the female partner. And sadly, data show household dynamics have not progressed much since 1985. While the two-thirds imbalance is an average, some partnerships are more balanced, some less, these journals give us a good indication of where we are as a nation. There are many same-sex relationships that mirror this unequal divide, as well as households where the male partner is doing the lion's share of work. Oftentimes I get asked, how can I, the laborer in my home, make a change? My partner will not budge, and I am at the breaking point. What do I do? To be honest, I do not love these questions. I do not believe we should task the person already doing two-thirds of household work with another to-do item. Ideally, the person in the one-third role would realize they could do more and then pitch in. But 35-plus years on the plateau tells us this is not realistic. So what would quiet quitting at home look like? First, we have to consider the actual tasks that need doing in the home: washing, cleaning, cooking, and laundry. Of course, if there are small children, pets, or an ill family member in the home, then you cannot stop these tasks completely. But maybe you don't do your partner's laundry anymore. As everyone who does all the things knows, the physical tasks are just half the load. To quietly quit at home, one must also find ways to back away from those invisible tasks that often feel the most burdensome and stressful. Since a lot of the cognitive labor falls into the necessary column, no one should stop scheduling medical appointments for the kids. But maybe you could tell your family that unless someone else does the meal planning and grocery shopping, everyone will be eating PB&Js every night for months. Ideally, quiet quitting in the home will lead to some long overdue conversations about the impact of domestic work imbalance. With willing participants and regular communication, it is possible to more equitably reappropriate cognitive and physical labor. Under the column World, or the headline World, this is the View essay on the Amazon's front lines. This is by Andrew Downey, and Downey's been reporting about Brazil and the Amazon for more than 20 years. A Time Studios documentary about Uru Iu Wau Wau, the territory, will have premiered by now on the Disney Geographic Channel, and it will stream on Disney Plus. In the south of the Amazon, just where two dirt roads cross, is a small bar set back a bit from the highway. There is no name over the door because it's part of a house, really, but everyone calls it Juiga's Bar after its owner. Like many of the bars dotted across the region, Juiga's is ramshackle and no frills. There's a pool table along one side and a few tables and chairs out front, but that is it. People go to get some shade, grab a beer, and swap local gossip, not for the decor or ambiance. Now, Juiga is spelled G-U-I-G-A, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing it. The last known whereabouts of Ari Uru Iu Wau Wau was in Juiga's Bar, sometime before midnight, April 18, 2020. Ari was a member of the Uru Iu Wau Wau indigenous people, and he had spent the evening drinking in a series of bars scattered along the unpaved roads near the group's reservation. The next morning, his body was found at the side of a road around half an hour away. His head was caked with blood that had dried quickly in the searing heat. His phone was nestled in the grass a few feet away. On the sides of the road were walls of grass, and behind that were fields where the mighty Amazon rainforest had once stood. The story of Ari Uru Iu Wau Wau and the investigation into his murder is in one way the story of Brazilian indigenous peoples: their genocide, their daily struggles in a hostile world, their fight for justice. But it's also a contemporary tale of climate change, Brazil, and the influence of Jair Bolsonaro, the recently defeated Brazilian president, whose disregard for the Amazon and its inhabitants has led the whole planet to the edge of environmental Armageddon. Indigenous people have been under siege since Bolsonaro took power 4 years ago, and the Amazon has borne the brunt of his neglect. Deforestation, land grabs, and violence are up. Equality, credibility, and empathy are down. People like the Uru Iuwauwau have good reason to lament the former army captain's reign. It was in the 1970s, as the military forged a path into the untouched part of the jungle, that the Uru Iuwauwau first came into recorded contact with a Brazil they had never hoped to meet. The Amazon was, and still is, Brazil's Wild West, and the military dictators of the time saw it as a weak spot, a vast frontier coveted by bigger geopolitical powers and vulnerable to outside invasions. It was also an El Dorado, a treasure trove of metals, jewels, plants, animals, and raw materials ripe for the picking. So the military sent diggers to cut roads into the forest and encourage people to go down them and plant a flag for the fatherland. In the slogan of the time, they offered a land without men for men without land, and millions took them up on it. It spelled disaster for the Uru Iuwauwau and hundreds of other indigenous groups. Today, the Uru Iuwauwau number only about 200, most of whom live in six communities scattered around a 1.8 million hectare reservation in Rondônia, one of the nine Brazilian states that make up the Amazon. The territory is being squeezed on all sides by loggers and ranchers, and it's that pressure, say the Uru Iuwauwau, that led to the death of Ari, a schoolteacher and leader, taken at the age of just 35. Killing indigenous people got easier in Brazil these past few years. Before taking office, Bolsonaro vowed not to give them one more centimeter of land, and he was true to his word. Bolsonaro hollowed out the state agency charged with protecting indigenous groups, known as FUNAI, F-U-N-A-I, and he let environmental agencies rot, starving them of funds and staff, and deliberately creating conditions for loggers, miners, ranchers, and hunters to invade with impunity. Deforestation has gone up every year since he took power, this year hitting a 15-year high. An astonishing 99% of all deforestation in 2021 contained indications of illegality, according to a study by Map Biomas. Violence has soared, and indigenous people feel under siege. Even though reservations are fenced off to keep the invaders out, not to keep the native people in, invasions by hunters and prospectors after land, gold, timber, and fish went from 109 in 2018 to 305 last year, according to CIMI, C-I-M-I, an indigenous rights group. The Amazon's now home to all kinds of opportunists, from small farmers grabbing a parcel of land to make a home and plant a few bananas, to international crime syndicates taking advantage of the vacuum. Drug trafficking organizations, arms trafficking organizations, illegal fishing and hunting organizations, they're all operating in the Amazon now, says Sueli Araujo, a former head of IBAMA, I-B-A-M-A, the conservation and sustainable development arm of the Ministry of the Environment. And yet being in the Amazon is magical. On a river in absolute silence, bar the hum of the motor and the water lapping the sides of the boat. In the undergrowth, surrounded by shafts of yellow light and the pungent smell of wet soil. At night, below skies with so many stars they seem to light up the ground beneath them. Protecting these wonders became so much harder under Bolsonaro. The whole point of FUNAI, whose forerunner was set up in 1910, is to secure land for the most endangered indigenous groups and then monitor the reservations to ensure invaders are kept out. Its mission statement is to protect and promote the rights of Brazil's indigenous peoples. But when Bolsonaro starved it of funds, the opportunists poured in, often telling anyone who challenged them the president had their backs. It was a shock to people like Ari and Bitate, the Uru Iu Wa'u Wa'u's 22-year-old leader, and they instinctively knew they had to react. Now when they get word of illegal deforestation on their land, they don't just inform Funai, they pack their bags, power up their drones, and set out to resolve the problem. They do so as members of the Guardians of the Forest, a cross between a patrol and a pressure group. Indigenous people across Brazil have formed similar troops over the past 10 years as a way to combat encroachment and destruction. Using modern technology to delineate their land and traditional tools to protect themselves, it is one of the few ways they can actively defend the place they call home. When news of incursions came in, Ari gathered at dawn with other Uru Iu Wa'u Wa'u guardians, and together they would hike into the forest, backpacks over one shoulder, bows and arrows over the other. They knew the invaders were dangerous. We're always being threatened, says Bitate. But drones helped them see what they were dealing with from afar. If the invaders were alone or unarmed, they could scare them off or even in rare cases hand them over to police. Sometimes they settled for destroying the shacks the invaders holed up in. Other times they would make off with their food or stove, or if they were really lucky, with their chainsaws. Often they needed just to make their presence felt for the invaders to retreat. Ari used to say, "We are survivors. This is our land. This is where we are from," Bitate says. He wanted to protect it not just for himself, but for his children and his grandchildren. When he died, we lost someone who was always on the front lines, someone who said, "We must not bow our heads." There are finally reasons for optimism. October 30, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva was elected president, defeating Bolsonaro. The Amazon and climate were two of the recurring themes of the campaign, and Lula has promised to repeat the success from a decade ago, when his government reduced deforestation by more than 80%. Most notably for the Uru Iu Wa'u Wa'u, Lula has vowed to give indigenous people more control over their own affairs. "Get ready, Brazil's indigenous people, because I am going to create a ministry for native peoples," he said in August. "Get ready, because Funai will no longer be run by a white man with green eyes. It will be run by an indigenous man or woman." Here's the page with 8 questions. Today it features Jay Inslee, I-N-S-L-E-E, governor of Washington State, on the enormous U.S. climate investment, his own state's bill, and a new light at COP27. There's a photograph here in black and white of Jay Inslee wearing another dark plaid sports jacket over a pale-colored, we don't know what color, open at the neck shirt. He has short cropped gray hair and wearing glasses, and some either smiling or speaking probably to the camera. Question and answers are the formats for this. Question: why make the trip here to Egypt to attend COP27, this year's UN climate conference? Answer: number one is to give the world confidence America as a whole is moving, and that was an important job, particularly during the darkness of the Trump administration. We wanted to wave the flag and show the rest of the world there is hope. Question: how has the reception to an American presence at a conference like this changed since the Trump administration years? Answer: darkness to light. Now there is light. It is a 180-degree change, and people are very appreciative of it. They understand the change that both the administration has brought and the states have brought. Question: how has the Inflation Reduction Act, the landmark climate bill passed in August, affected policy efforts in Washington State? Answer. First off, it is enormous, $350 billion. The scale is not only tremendous, but the comprehensive nature of it is tremendous. It uses multiple tools and investments, not just one. You have got the tax credits that can be used by private entities. Then you've got grant programs from soup to nuts, from charging to electric school buses to information technology, you name it. So it's very, very flexible and very comprehensive. Question, but not perfect. Answer, there's some things we need to work on. We're going to need the federal government to really put the pedal to the metal on permitting. It's going to be a shame to have a couple $1 billion and not be able to spend it because you cannot get the permits to get the job. And so we need to bolster the infrastructure of permitting. On a federal level, we need to do the same thing in the state. Question. What role can states and other regional governments play in addressing climate change? Answer. We are moving even further and faster than the federal government. We've got the second floor of a two-story building. Question. In your state, you tried and failed to pass various big climate policies, a carbon tax, a cap and trade bill, etc. And now you're finally implementing a cap and invest bill. What's the lesson? Answer. We ultimately got it through the use of two great renewable fuels, perseverance and optimism. I persevered for 10 years on this and outlasted the Republicans. We now have more Democratic majorities that made this possible, and we crafted a finely tuned bill that addressed multiple needs. This is not easy work, and you've just got to keep pounding away. Question. The bill raises funds by auctioning off carbon emissions allowances for businesses. Which of the resulting investments are you most excited about? Answer. One of the best things about this program, it invested $6 billion in transportation that we desperately needed, a billion of which goes directly to low and zero carbon transportation. And then we also were very acutely aware of making sure we did this with environmental justice in mind. 40% of the revenues have to go to disproportionately impacted communities, and an additional 10% directly to tribal operations. So we embedded environmental justice in the whole thing. And frankly, that made it more attractive to some folks as well. Question, do you expect this momentum to continue? Answer, it is going to accelerate for two reasons. Number one, unfortunately, catastrophes are accelerating in intensity. And then there are so many exciting stories of job creation. I cannot turn over a rock in my state without finding somebody with a new business, hiring great people with a great wage. That column was written by Justin Warland. Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. The brief time with celebrity entrepreneur Mark Cuban is taking on Big Pharma by Charlotte Alter Dallas. Mark Cuban, C-U-B-A-N, Mark Cuban, the tech titan, Dallas Mavericks owner, star of ABC's Shark Tank, moves through the world like a friendly great white, all teeth and eyes and relentless motion. When we met on an October morning at his office in the Mavericks headquarters, the serial entrepreneur, 64, is wearing a long-sleeved T-shirt advertising his last investment, Mark Cuban Cost Plus Drug Company. I was there to find out why a guy who's made billions in tech, won an NBA championship, and become perhaps the most popular businessman on reality TV, was spending his time and fortune hawking generic antifungal medications online for $7.34. To F-space CK things up, Cuban explains. That's what capitalism's all about. Capitalism isn't just everybody should make as much money as they can. Capitalism is about finding solutions to problems and seeing what you can do to solve them. Cost Plus Drugs, which launched in January, is Cuban's attempt to prove disruption can be a form of benevolence. The for-profit online pharmacy aims to undercut the healthcare industry by selling generic drugs for everything from asthma to glaucoma to rheumatoid arthritis for a fraction of the typical price. Cuban likes to say the company's real product is transparency. In an industry where hospitals can sell cancer drugs at a 600% markup, Cost Plus sells generic medications for the cost of manufacturing them, plus a 15% markup in shipping fees. The goal, says Cuban, is to become the biggest low-cost provider of medication in America. Although Cuban will not say exactly how much of the company he owns, he calls the new online pharmacy a win-win. If established pharmacies keep charging patients artificially high prices, Cost Plus may emerge as a popular low-cost alternative. If the industry slashes consumer prices to compete, he will have almost single-handedly brought reform to an industry that stubbornly resists it. The incumbents could come along and copy us. Get a heart, get a conscience, Cuban says. That would be okay. For decades, politicians have been promising to reduce the cost of prescription drugs, and for decades they've mostly failed. To Cuban, the persistent inability to address runaway drug pricing has reinforced his dim view of the political system's ability to solve big problems. He not only believes the healthcare system is broken, he also thinks American government is too messed up to fix it. For a guy who expresses himself through assets and acquisitions, plus the occasional podcast episode, Cost Plus Drugs represents a billionaire's search for meaning in a world that is increasingly skeptical of the power of the uber-rich. Cuban's counterparts in the 0.01% have become political megadonors, started global foundations, become patrons of the arts and humanities. He prefers to build his legacy the way he has built his fortune, through entrepreneurship. Cost Plus Drugs is a kind of middle path between progressive reform and philanthropic giving, one that aims to disrupt predatory markets as a way of regulating them. The venture has a long way to go to upend the $1.4 trillion pharmaceutical industry. Cost Plus Drugs offers about 1,000 medications in the U.S., a small fraction of the drugs available, and does not yet take most insurance, although Cuban says that will change in 2023. While some customers say Cost Plus has lowered their medical bills, it is too early to tell whether the model can scale. Mark Cuban has managed to disrupt a very small slice of the healthcare system, says Larry Levitt, executive vice president at the nonpartisan health policy organization KFF, who called out-of-pocket generic drugs the low-hanging fruit of the system. It remains to be seen whether he can figure out a way to expand that slice. Cuban's email address is publicly available, and hundreds of investment pitches land in his inbox every week. He reads the first paragraph and deletes them 99% of the time, he says. But in 2018, Cuban got a cold email from Dr. Alex Oshmiansky, a radiologist, asking if he would consider investing in a company that sells generic medications for roughly the cost of production. He responded within 5 minutes. The more questions I asked him about the drug side of things, Cuban says, the more obvious it was that there was an opportunity there. You might not expect that an entrepreneur as buzzy as Cuban would be drawn to the world of generic pharmaceuticals, but long before Oshmiansky's email landed in his inbox, Cuban had been interested in the inefficiencies in the healthcare industry. He had taken note of the controversy surrounding PharmaBro, Martin Shkreli, who in 2015 jacked up the price of Doraprim, a life-saving antiparasitic drug, from $13.50 to $750 per pill. And Martin's last name is spelled S-H-K-R-E-L-I. If the pharma bro can jack up prices, that means that there's some distortion of pricing, Cuban says, and there must be a way to reduce them the same way. Watching President Trump and congressional Republicans work to eliminate the Affordable Care Act without a viable replacement, he adds, convinced him the two-party system was not well equipped to handle health care. Cuban pushed Oshmiansky, who launched the company as a nonprofit in 2015, to turn the enterprise into a for-profit company, arguing it would be more sustainable if it were not reliant on fundraising. His fortune has created a long runway, and his fame has allowed him to spread the word about an enterprise that might have otherwise languished in obscurity. It is not even so much Mark's capital, it's his celebrity that's been the magic key that has unlocked a lot of this, says Oshmiansky. Mark's platform is actually much more valuable than the capital he is able to provide. The company has had some growing pains. Its staff of 33 has struggled to keep up with skyrocketing demand, even as the menu of drugs the company offers remains limited. Selling each drug requires complex negotiations with manufacturers and regulators, and Cost Plus Drugs does not yet offer medications like insulin, misoprostol, or epinephrine auto-injectors for peanut allergies. They're building a manufacturing plant near its Dallas headquarters to make drugs on site, but it won't be finished for months. Some customers have complained that their medications take too long to arrive, or that customer service is slow. Cuban says these are the growing pains of a bare-bones team trying to serve more than 1.3 million accounts. Other customers say Cost Plus has already helped them. Andrew Hums, a 37-year-old auto salesman in Pennsylvania, says he saved more than $600 on a three-month prescription for an assortment of diabetes and blood pressure medication. That is more than a car payment for most people, he says. For some people, that is rent. Cuban, who's worth an estimated $4.6 billion, says he's not in it to make my next dollar, nor is he interested in a run for political office, despite the long-standing rumors. That is the one thing I know I'd suck at, he says. Instead, Cost Plus Drugs is part of a playbook to use his fortune for a new type of benevolent disruption. I could go on to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing, he says. But it wouldn't be as a politician, it would be as a capitalist. From The View, the risk report by Ian Bremmer, Erdogan's delicate balancing act, that is E-R-D-O-G-A-N. November 13, an explosion on Istiklal Avenue, Istanbul's busiest pedestrian street, killed 6 people and injured more than 80. Turkish authorities immediately accused Kurdish groups of a terrorist attack, the first in Turkey's capital in nearly 6 years. The blast was condemned in Europe, the U.S., Russia, and elsewhere, but this latest attack will only complicate the already complex foreign policy that President Recep Tayyip Erdogan hopes will help him and his party win re-election in Turkey's elections next June. After 20 years at center stage in Turkish politics, Erdogan knows he faces a rough road ahead. His country's economy is in bad shape. Inflation is surging. The currency is sinking. Voters feel the pain. Tourism is crucial to any economic revival, and an attack in the heart of Istanbul will take a toll. Erdogan knows he cannot afford Western sanctions, whether in response to the purchase of Russian weapons in violation of NATO rules, actions by Turkish entities that violate U.S. sanctions on Iran, violations of democratic norms at home, or any other outstanding issue. but he can see that his country's strategic importance at a time of war in Ukraine can help him blunt or delay sanction threats from Washington and Brussels. At the same time, European and American leaders know they need pragmatic relations with Erdogan because he can offer real help or serious obstacles when it comes to Russia and Ukraine. Turkey has provided Ukraine with weaponized drones that have boosted its forces at critical moments during the war. Erdogan's government is central to the grain deal that allowed ships carrying Ukrainian food products across the Black Sea toward international markets. He can create back channels for Russian and Ukrainian negotiations. But Erdogan has refused to impose sanctions on Russia, and he can play a crucial role, if he chooses, in helping Russia evade some U.S. and European penalties. He could complicate the NATO admission process for Sweden and Finland. Erdogan also has a long history of stoking anti-Western anger in his country, particularly when he needs to rally domestic support in times of economic hardship. Though his own comments after the Istanbul bombing were muted, his interior minister publicly rejected Western statements of condolence and claimed the central suspect in the attack planned on fleeing to rival and fellow NATO member Greece. For all these reasons, Western leaders will tread carefully. But Erdogan has to be careful too. Western sanctions would deal a heavy blow to Turkey's economic resilience in ways that could boost Erdogan's domestic opposition and leave him dangerously reliant on Vladimir Putin's goodwill. Putin has successfully blackmailed Erdogan in the past with a ban on Russian tourists traveling to Turkey. Erdogan's delicate dance with the West will continue. He can win support with nationalists at home by repeatedly complicating and delaying Sweden and Finland's accession into NATO without drawing Western ire by blocking it altogether. He can shake his fist at rival Greece without taking concrete actions that anger Brussels. He can bolster his electoral base with more tough talk on Kurds inside Turkey and more attacks on Kurdish groups in Iraq and Syria, while keeping Western criticism at bay via support for Ukraine. But Turkey's economy will only weaken further until Erdogan takes a fundamentally different approach to the ways his government spends money and his central bank manages interest rates. An economic crisis, a real risk in 2023, would make all of Erdogan's problems much worse. As this latest terrorist attack reminds us, it is harder to maintain a delicate balancing act when destabilizing events are outside even a leader's control. This is Viewpoint. What are we fighting for? Autocrats are rapidly weaponizing the globalized world. Ukraine is where we see if they can be stopped. This is by Peter Pomerantsev. This is a long article which may be abbreviated. Sheltering from Iranian kamikaze Shahed drones in the Kiev metro in October, I tried to hide my extreme nervousness while simultaneously scrolling through social media videos of anti-regime protests in Iran, where relentlessly courageous crowds of women were ripping off their shawls in defiance of the Ayatollahs who sell the Shahed drones to the Kremlin, which then uses them to attack civilians in the city of my birth. It was a reminder of how the war in Ukraine is about fighting not only Russia, but also a whole network of authoritarian regimes. Vladimir Putin claims Russia's invasion will usher in a new era of what he calls a multipolar world, but which in practice means an era where the Russias, Chinas, and Irans of this world are increasingly free to strip away the last vestiges of human rights and humanitarian rules, where big states are ever more free to suffocate smaller ones in their spheres of influence, where the powerful can murder critics with impunity, where fossil fuel dictatorships can hold the world ransom, where any hope of speaking truth to power is sunk under a deluge of disinformation, and the state can surveil your every digital footprint. But Putin miscalculated. Instead of strengthening his authoritarian network, the invasion of Ukraine can be a rallying point for democratic solidarity. As I sat in the Kiev metro and sighed with relief at the boom of American and Norwegian air defense systems taking out the Shahed drones, I found myself rooting on the Iranian protests even harder. Victory in their struggle would help secure our survival. Similarly, anti-corruption investigative journalists, environmental activists, and digital rights campaigners around the world all have a role to play in defeating Russian aggression. And Ukraine's victory in Kherson will in turn deter China from launching wars in Asia. Russia's invasion of Ukraine is the flashpoint in the great struggle of the 21st century between one version of an interconnected world that gives justice, freedoms, and rights a chance, and a much darker prospect of weaponized interdependence, where everything from the cost of your food on your supermarket shelves to your domestic energy bills, what media your children watch on their phones, what will be taught in our universities, will be defined by the Putins and Xi Jinpings. But it would be a mistake to imagine this new competition as some sort of Cold War redo, with two neat sides with clear opposing ideologies, communism versus democratic capitalism, and two clear geographical blocks. Though some of the underlying conflicts may be the same between systems that crush people as a point of political principle and those who at least try to value people's dignity, the tactics, territories, and political visions that are completely different from those of the 20th century. This was not how the arc of history was meant to bend. After the divisions of the Cold War, many thought we were entering what the New York Times columnist Thomas L. Friedman called the Age of Globalization. In this interconnected global village, the free flow of money, goods, information, and cultural exchange across borders would supposedly lead to countries like China and Russia becoming more like us through increased contact. Instead, something much more insidious has emerged. The free flow of money has enabled kleptocracy and corrupt influence. The growth of trade has not made dictatorships more like democracies, but allowed dictatorships to have leverage over democracies. Welcome to a world where China punishes Australia when it dares to criticize Beijing's abuse of human rights, where Russia can close off Ukraine's grain exports and thus risk starving countries in the global south in order to blackmail the world into allowing Moscow to pursue genocide in Ukraine, and where Moscow manipulates energy prices in the West to force Europe and the U.S. to acquiesce to its political demands. At a speech in Taipei in October, the historian Ann Applebaum, my colleague at the SNF Agora Institute, Johns Hopkins University, used the term Autocracy, Inc. to describe how authoritarian regimes have learned to support one another. The corrupt state-controlled companies in one dictatorship do business with corrupt state-controlled companies in another. The police in one country can arm, equip, and train the police in another. Unlike military or political alliances from other times and places, the members of this group do not operate like a bloc, but rather like an agglomeration of companies. Call it Autocracy, Inc., Their links are cemented not by ideals, but by deals. Another of my Johns Hopkins colleagues, Henry Farrell, frames the economic aspect of this tussle from the perspective of what he calls weaponized interdependence. America has thus far been able to dominate, for good and ill, a global system where it can impose sanctions on any company via the American-controlled dollar trading system. Now Russia and China want to weaponize interdependence, and it will be much more ruthless. This goes beyond mere state-on-state economic bullying to manipulating whole supply chains. After Lithuania angered China by allowing a representative office for Taiwan to open in the Baltic state, China did not just attack Lithuanian companies directly, but also pressured German companies to stop using any Lithuanian parts in its cars if they wanted access to Chinese consumers. In the romantic version of the global village, transnational media was meant to bring mutual understanding across borders. Russia exploits the free flow of information with its armies of bots and state media channels, and China instills Confucius institutes in universities across the world, which give generous funds and then limit what academics can say on China. Instead of internet technology bringing people across the globe closer to democracy, any aspiring autocrat can shop for what have been called authoritarian services, such as surveillance technologies from China or Pegasus spyware from Israel, that let them monitor their citizens to an unprecedented extent. Chris Walker, Vice President for Analysis at the National Endowment for Democracy, calls these transnational tactics sharp power, as opposed to the idea of states having soft power, which makes them attractive to foreign populations. These days, the aim is to be feared, not loved. But the systems that sharp power takes advantage of are created in and for the benefit of democracies, the shady offshore tax havens that enable the free flow of dirty money were created by democracies and make money for the financial sector in democracies. Corruption is not something from over there that comes here. It is implicit in the system we created. Likewise, with the world of online disinformation campaigns, Russia distorts the truth about its crimes in Ukraine simply by using Western social media, which is built in such a way that a citizen has little right to know who is manipulating them and how. Why algorithms show you one piece of content and not another? Which part of your data is being used by whom and for what purpose? Ukraine has become crucial, the crucial front where this future is being decided. Ukraine's resilience and victories on the battlefield mean Russia's attempt to usher in its bad new world are not going to plan. But to secure Ukraine's sovereignty and our own, we need to break the power of networked authoritarians and the way they weaponize interdependence. The two processes are synonymous. Putin thought that other countries' desire to do business with Russia and their energy dependency on Russia, especially, would give him a free hand in Ukraine. Things have not gone that smoothly. Many companies have pulled out, Europe scrambling toward energy freedom from Russia. But many companies have also stayed. Many do business through intermediaries and shell companies. Many countries in Europe remain reliant on Russian fossil fuels. The companies still trading in Russia are not just unethical. They're making us all less safe and our lives more expensive by emboldening Putin ever more. In order to increase pressure on companies and countries still doing business with the Kremlin, we will need a much more aggressive civil society that marshals environmental activists, anti-corruption researchers, supporters of Ukraine's sovereignty, to pressure those companies and politicians that sell out our security, environment, and long-term prosperity. It is time to put an end to the myth that more trade will automatically lead to peace. economics has to be reconnected to security and values. The war in Ukraine has also reinforced the need for more democratic regulation of the Internet. Many of the Russian online campaigns are non-transparent, hiding their origin behind websites that impersonate genuine news sources and fake accounts. We need to push for regulation of tech companies that will give citizens the right to know who's trying to influence them and how platforms enable this. Russian propaganda has also surfaced the issue of the legal culpability of propagandists. We're not talking here merely about repugnant forms of speech, but coordinated information campaigns involving both legacy and online media that build in the run-up to and the aftermath of attacks on civilian objects. Putin's minions, both propagandist and military, believe they can commit war crimes with impunity. They may be about to discover they are wrong. This article has been just slightly abridged by Peter Pomerantsev, who's the author of This Is Not Propaganda, Adventures in the War Against Reality. He's a senior fellow at the SNF Agora Institute, Johns Hopkins University. There are a couple of photos here, very gray, very dark. Kiev after missile strikes knocked out power. A damaged apartment block in Mykolaiv, wheat storage on a farm outside Lviv. It's all shattered concrete with construction cranes, silhouettes in the dark against a purple sky, and tan wheat piled up in an old granary with windows and a wooden roof. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance, that's GSUGGSinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138, that is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.